Thank you, everybody, for coming to the Berkman Center. This is quite an impressive crew. The most important thing I can say, in a way, is that the Berkman Center has had a major upgrade with in the executive director department, of course, taking over. You've had the experience of Wursa's hosting, not me. But congratulations also to Oliver and John and others for this convening. I'm sorry I wasn't here this morning, but I was involved in another conference which was totally virtual, where I was the speaker in one of those totally disembodied cloud experiences using Illuminate. So I thought it was fitting that you all were having a cloud computing conversation. I was presenting to people from all over the world on the Global Knowledge Commons and reading Professor McAfee's Twitter posts about what you were saying in here as I was speaking to other people. It was totally bizarre. But the takeaway I had as I walked from campus over to here around lunchtime was one thing that I think at about the same time Herbert Burkert was talking about as an evolving system, which was it's when you speak into Illuminate, I don't know if you guys have had this pleasure, and you're sharing your screen, you're looking into your screen with your slides, which everybody else is seeing, and people all around the world listening to you, but getting zero feedback at all. It's a miserable experience, right? It's wonderful in the sense that we're able to have this conversation, but it's so clear that we're at version 0.1 that you're getting no feedback. I have no idea if they can hear me. All I see is the little light on my Mac at the top that's green, noting a camera is coming toward me. And I was thinking that relative to cloud computing, we're in a way at the same moment where we have a sense of what the potential of this is, and that there may be a difference in degree, if not in kind, which I picked up from a Twitter post. But also that we have a lot of work to do to shape, in fact, the future that we're after. We have a sense of what this can be, but there's a lot that lies ahead of us. And so segueing into this session, we're going to hear first from Oliver, then from David Johnson, and then Jonathan Zittrain, our colleague, is going to swoop in the door and then start talking after these guys. And then we will get back to the discussion format. So I think, Oliver, I turn it over to you, and then David next, and Zittrain when he arrives.
Shifting the prepositional space for a moment. I think that a lot of what we've been talking about here this morning has depended upon what preposition we put in between the words law and cloud. The title of the session didn't have a preposition or a conjunction for that matter and just said cloud law, so I think we've been free to supply our own. But it depends really whether we're talking about the law of the cloud, which is about some of what we've been talking about, but also law in the cloud, law from the cloud. There are a lot of different prepositions we can put there, and the preposition that I'm interested, or prepositions I'm particularly interested in, are in and from in this kind of context, because I'm really interested in the degree to which the cloud can be not just a subject of law, but a source of law for people, and the ability to derive law and law-like institutions from the cloud, however we choose to define that. And in that context, I like David Reed's notion of the cloud as a utility. The cloud is a place where you can go and get things you need, whether or not you know where they came from. As long as they suit your needs, that's what is fine. Law has typically not been that kind of utility. Law has typically been a more bespoke, more sort of rooted jurisdiction. You know, you don't have that much choice about law. Although, even classically, there is some choice in the notion that we can have...
Hello, Professor Zittrain. Give him a wave. There he is. You're the third of three panelists, so...
Oh,
Oliver,
good.
Oliver first, then Johnson.
My last name comes in handy again.
That's exactly right.
There is the idea of private law, that law is something that we can design to some degree ourselves, and I'm going to pick up on that as I go forward for a moment. But I wanted to start off just putting down my own definitional marker on institutions, because I think that one of the questions is law is a kind of subset of institutions, and part of really the law in the cloud is a subset of a study we've been doing really around the notion of digital institutions. What happens when you migrate institutions into a digital sphere? And that digital sphere, that depends on what we mean by institutions. And what I like to think about is it's institutions are something that set expectations that we can hope to rely on, and then create ways in which we make expectations in an interactive sense, when we interact with other people, either socially or economically or whatever that may be, and then make defections from that set of expectations costly and therefore make compliance likely. So an institution is something that reshapes our behavior space a bit to create things that we can rely on and places within which we can have reliable relations. If you'll take that idea for a moment, then one of the interesting things about the cloud is that it may, to the extent particularly that the law is a kind of a subset of that sort of institutional space, the cloud may be a place that we can go to as a source of institutions, as a source of places we can find reliable playing spaces, if you like, reliable places to have economic relations, to have other kinds of relations through the intermediation of something that's provided by the cloud. That has some benefits. It opens up a much broader sphere potentially for some of the kind of private orderings we've talked about. It also opens up some competition. The traditional world is not without its competition. Delaware always said, you know, come to us for your corporations, that kind of thing. There is some competition that exists. But this would augment that, would expand it rather radically to say that there are places I can go, there are jurisdictions I can go to access my legal structures that are not just where I'm used to. If I'm in Uzbekistan and I happen to like the law of the law of Monaco for my legal things, I could the web is a way, the digital world is a way to do that. And again, we could then view the cloud, we could have a cloud of legal resources as well as a cloud of other kinds of resources supplied in that context. Well, what are two or three additional things to think about as we think about that? One of them is the question of what is the source of law? Do we need a traditional style sovereign as the source of our law? And indeed, that is often, but not always, the case. For instance, in our Vermont digital project, which you've heard referred to, the source of the underlying backstopping source of law there is Vermont, and Vermont has taken the step of allowing business organizations formed under its law to use digital means of communication, digital means of setting themselves up. Software instead of written agreements, that kind of thing, in a way that enables it then to really migrate the formation and operation of a business organization into a fully virtual sphere where nobody has to ever meet each other, nobody ever has to ever trade a piece of paper, all of that kind of thing. So that all of the kind of thing that you would do around an organization has been authorized to be done electronically, digitally through the means of the internet or however. Luckily, it's open ended, so when the next iteration comes out, as long as it's reasonably structured and agreed to, it's available effectively. So again, that's an example of where we use an established state based sovereign as the backstop for this kind of thing. I think we're also seeing the emergence of non-state-based sovereigns, non-traditional sovereigns, in a sense. I think that one can view eBay as a kind of a non-state-based sovereign. Now, you know, way back there somewhere, there's still some contract law that's underlying it. But most people do all of their transactions through eBay, only talking to eBay. If they have a dispute, they have dispute resolution through eBay. They pay through eBay. It's all, you know, there is an entire kind of little governance that is eBay. And I've been told that the head of eBay has referred to him or herself as the mayor of eBay, you know, again, sort of asserting this kind of quasi-state circumstance. That is a way for designing private law. What you don't see, I think, so much yet is the private sovereigns opening the space up for private sub-design, as it were. You know, okay, I'm in eBay, but I'm the duchy of Oliver within eBay, and in my duchy of Oliver, you know, here's how we play within the subset of eBay. Again, that's a possibility, but we haven't seen that yet. And the final thing I would mention on this is, and perhaps the most radical, is to a pure peer-to-peer thing, where we're not relying on either an actual sovereign or some kind of technology sovereign to be the controller of the thing, but rather arranging principles of interaction which create institutions that are stable in their own right. And before you go crazy trying to imagine this into a digital world, imagine it into a traditional world where things like the documentary trade transaction was essentially that, where banks got together and devised a set of conventions around letters of credit and effectively
allowed international trade to go forward with almost no reference to outside of their own established interrelations. How did they stabilize that? Well, they stabilize it by things like repeat play, reputation, by essentially taking monetary hostages from each other. In the old-fashioned international sphere, you know, the Emperor of Rome and the Emperor of Persia traded hostages. Why? Because that gave them leverage on each other that provided peer-to-peer enforcement on various things. Nowadays, we tend to do it with monetary deposits and that sort of thing rather than people, which is probably an advance. So we're good to have done that. So anyway, I point out that there are techniques for doing that, and the evolution of that kind of thing will be very interesting. And it's one of the kinds of pieces of experiment that we're talking about when we think about this is a peer-to-peer legal structure or quasi-legal structure going to be better in some kinds of context? Will it allow us not only design freedom but certain kinds of competition? There's been discussion around what is the tax, what is the rents that can be extracted. Sovereigns have a tendency to extract rents for their ability to backstop transactions and for their control over it. Can we move outside? Can things like the currency, these new currency models, can we develop them in a peer-to-peer, you know, kind of circumstance? Anyway, I just want to put on the table that as we move to law and other kinds of institutions within the cloud, that there are going to be design spaces that will have some reference to our traditional ways of thinking about it, but also have design spaces that won't. And part of our project is really to try and figure those out, and part of my hope is that you'll make comments and suggestions as we go forward.
Amazing, Oliver, what you can pack into a medium short session by talking really fast and putting lots of big ideas. So we're going to go to David Johnson, then to Jonathan Zittrain. I just want to preface one of the issues we're going to pull out the other side of this is the conversation about eBay or other market winners as the default sovereigns in cloud law, and then what are the possibilities for other private sheriffs, a Zittrain concept that we'll get to, but by way of David Johnson, who disagrees, helpfully, with Oliver on several scores, as we'll hear in a moment.
I want to try to disagree with Oliver. We've obviously been collaborating in many ways, but first I'd say that you can't think of law as a utility, and you can't even think of the sovereign as the source of law. The source of the law is people, obviously, and what law is, in my view, is a conversation among a group of people about what rules to apply, particularly when exercising whatever they control collectively by way of force. So what the net has done in its first cloud already is to potentially change the definition of the group that is having that conversation. And a second important element what the cloud now makes possible, I think, is the formation of entities that govern themselves. So think of this as raindrops in the cloud. The traditional term would be legal persons that the law takes seriously as the possessors of rights and duties of their own, and that to whom, at least with regard to internal decisions that don't lead to undue exporting of harm onto others, the traditional legal system defers. I suggest you take a look at a paper that's on the website for the conference by Paul Schiff Berman called Cosmopolitan Pluralism, in which he makes the point that every group that asserts that it's the right group to make a decision to resolve a dispute is essentially asserting jurisdiction. The idea of jurisdiction is not limited to traditional governments. And the question posed for every jurisdiction is when to defer to decisions by other groups, and I have some thoughts on that. The main topic, I think, should be how could we experiment meaningfully with the invention of new institutions. Even eBay is doing this, by the way. In the context of eBay India, they have created a jury system in which somebody who feels aggrieved by an adverse reputational rating can cause eBay to convene 25 experienced eBay users who will hear the arguments on both sides, and eBay commits itself to follow the result of 60% of that group, if you will. So there are interesting innovations, I think, potentially all over the place. I wanted to say a little bit about the details, concretely, of what you encounter when you try to create a legal person in the cloud, as we have done in the Vermont context. I'll just describe the choices we made, not because they're necessarily the right ones, lots of different models will compete, but to give you the idea of the choices that are opened up by virtue of being in the cloud. First of all, you can decide to form a company based on pooling time and effort rather than capital. There's lots of state statutes that have a default model for what a corporation should be. They're all based on the notion that you need money to induce people to give their efforts to building value for the entity. We've learned from the Yochai Benkler's work on peer production and others that people will do this for love, and maybe they'll do it even more for having an ownership stake in the net value they create, but without necessarily having to be hired as employees in the first instance. So because limited liability company law makes it possible to write more or less anything you can think of as an operating agreement, we structured a default operating agreement that eliminates a board of directors, no duty to any shareholders, in fact, no shareholders, self-selection for jobs inside the company, mutual evaluation of the value of contributions by the horizontal group with a joint decision-making about when, if ever, to distribute net proceeds based on those mutual ratings. So people in principle could come from anywhere and enjoy the backstop protection of Vermont contract law for purposes of enforcing this kind of relationship. What we haven't yet figured out is how to get a bank to open an account for a virtual company, because even if the sovereign state of Vermont duly declares that this is an entity that is incorporated in Vermont as a limited liability company, and even though there's nobody who could step forward and say, I have the power to control this entity, the bank wants a person to appear at their branch. So that's an example of the ways in which traditional law, having been engineered around our assumptions that companies would have buildings and be located, you know, someplace and so forth, gets in the way of forming new institutions. I wanted to, and obviously these companies can be formed for either for-profit purposes, but also for non-profit purposes, and that may be, in fact, the most impactful early way for the law to create structure here. I wanted to explain the underlying theory here in terms of Larry Lessig's traditional way of segmenting the forces that act on the world in terms of markets and law and code and norms, and say that I think, in fact, if we look at how clusters of activity and sustained activity in the cloud will emerge, that that's an incomplete, not inaccurate, but incomplete. Because what actually happens is that variations of each of those things come together, sort of like a folding polypeptide, to create an active site, a role in which somebody is directing their time and attention in a constrained way, and therefore doing what Stuart Kaufman would call work. But work defined and constrained with reference to the goals of a group. And so I think the important thing about the cloud, we've talked all morning as if it's all about individuals and maybe some powerful actors or maybe governments, and all the action is in groups, and groups that are defined with reference to the goals that they share as a group, which may not correspond to the goal of any individual in a precise way. So if we're going to invent a new cloud law, I think we have to use your authentication systems, not just to say, here's who I am individually, here's my identity, but also here's my membership, and here are the obligations I have to others, and here's my authority to act as an agent for this group, and you can trust me because, in part, I won't lose my membership in the group if I betray your trust. So that's my pitch.
That's great. Also speedy and full of lots of insight. I should say one of the things we should particularly credit Oliver and David for is providing us with one of the first tangible examples of what cloud law can look like in the form of this Vermont LLC arrangement, and also the notion, much like Creative Commons, that they've leaned into traditional law, going up to the legislature, dealing with legislators, getting them to pass something to be able to do this experimental thing, much as Creative Commons relies on traditional copyright law and then builds this alternative structure on top of it. It's a very interesting interplay. And I think Professor Zitrin down there is, in a way, one of the great experts on this same move of thinking about how the most expansive, interesting new things can be grounded in the traditional modes of law and technology. And I'm sure he has a few things to say about private sheriffs as well.
Just to say, but with your indulgence, I thought I would try to make it to our advantage in some way.
recently that, speaking of civic duty and law, I was off at the 3rd District Court of Middlesex today, next to the famed Meadow Glen Mall. There apparently is no 1st or 2nd District Court of Middlesex. I'm sure there's a story there.
No longer necessary.
Yes, exactly. and endured several hours of hurry up and wait kind of thing.
Which is to say jury duty, not representing somebody else.
That's true. Yet. Jury duty, yes. Jury duty. And then they sprang us all because all 15 conflicts settled, we were told. I'm like, what, is this America? What's going on here? So I thought, John, before I say what's on my mind, and I've got a little outline and everything, I thought I would ask you your sense of what are the main problems you think we are gathered to solve?
So this is a classic. Jonathan was the professor first. I was his student, and he sticks me with a hard question.
This is for extra credit.
Finally, I get my chance at extra credit as entrance class. Yeah, this is good. Jonathan also is quite famous at the Harvard Law School for getting his students to teach the class. So,
which, of course, takes at least twice as much work.
Actually, I don't think so.
You've stalled long enough, JP.
No, but the other thing you don't know is that I was in the cloud this morning doing a presentation on Illuminate about the global knowledge commons. So I actually wasn't here the whole time. But
okay.
But I will try to answer your question. I think, as precisely as we can put it, this group is gathered to say, first of all, we have an advent of a new technology, which is cloud computing, right? Is it really new?
And have we defined it?
Hold on. Yeah, there was a fair amount on
that.
I've been following this, so somebody else might do the definition. There, in fact, was a three-layered approach, very helpful, apparently.
I prefer seven myself. You could do a
seven-layered one in an early session. There's a discussion of degree versus kind in terms of difference, and I think that's fairly core to it. And then superimposing on top of that, are there implications, serious implications, degree or kind, for the way that law works? And I
yes.
think that my sense is, and I'm listening here as opposed to having really been there, but it was problematized by Anne-Marie and others in saying, a lot of the questions that we asked 10 years ago in cyber law when it seemed really cool and interesting about jurisdiction and
yes.
how you apply the law of one regime to another, choice of law and so forth, the things you've written about in
yes.
Be Careful What You Ask For and elsewhere, are re-raised in interesting
yes.
and further complex ways than
yes.
they were before. We heard Herbert Burkert, who may have left the room, sitting over here, talking about the law as evolutionary system, that it's in fact set up to do roughly this, and in fact it has a quality to it that does evolve with these kinds of changes. But I would imagine it needs to be calibrated, that evolution,
yes.
right, towards something we're after. So I guess I put it back in the form of a question which says, is there a problem here that we're trying to solve? If so, what is that problem exactly?
Yes.
And then what kind of a world do we want to identify that's better, right? And then
yes.
aim for that. So I hear between Oliver and David Johnson, the sovereign's question that I've pulled out as one example, which is, so let's imagine that you in fact have different decision-making spaces in the cloud where important things are happening, private transactions of various sorts,
yeah.
disputes of various sorts. Do we in fact have different decision makers
yes.
in that environment? Can you imagine a peer-to-peer one Oliver puts on the table? Can you imagine one where it's individual private actors that happen to be the market leaders, eBay as an example, or maybe it's Amazon or Microsoft or others who provide the service
yes.
that emerge? Is it just the old Jack Goldsmith move? It's just states. They'll find a way to superimpose their control here. It's just a matter of international relations. That will just happen here as it has in Web 1.0. Or is it some other thing? And maybe you're some other thing in the future of the internet way is in fact Oliver's peer-to-peer suggestion, or maybe
yes.
it's a fourth thing that's a variant that you might call the herd
yes.
in a way that's different than strictly peer-to-peer.
Yes.
So that's my answer.
Great. Extremely helpful to
plus?
Me.
Do I get a plus one?
You do. Plus
okay,
one.
Good. Thank you. Thank you.
Self-graded, of course.
Thank you, yeah.
She's a plus
yeah.
one.
Uh-huh. So, the reason I asked if we had a definition of the cloud is because, as is probably now well known, people mean different things when they invoke it. To me, it breaks down into at least two different ideas that can overlap. One is cloud as far away. It's out in the cloud. It's voicemail. It's not an answering machine. Your messages are now in the cloud. And that can mean far away, but in a specific location under a single entity's custody. Your voicemail is with Verizon. It can also mean distributed, not actually in any one place, the way a cloud really is, that once you're in the middle of the cloud, it feels strange because the cloud always seems to be somewhere other than where you are. Sorry.
And yet it has a fixed geography still, the cloud, doesn't it, in a literal sense?
I don't think so. I mean, again, it depends on...
No, I'm talking about just leading into your analogy. In a regular cloud, it is different than a cloud that has... You're saying it's different than the cloud you see outside of your plane.
Well, no, in the distributed sense, my thought is the reason why internet architects adopted as a term of art, rather than inventing a new word, which they're perfectly willing to do, why they called the cloud the quote-unquote middle of the internet was in part because there was no centralized map of the net and no easy way to know where the edge was and where the center was until you decided that you were the destination you've been waiting for and you were going to make use of the packet that had been handed your way. And that sense of distributed is very different from the simple sense of remote and far. Both have implications for thinking through law. Probably the distributed conception is the more interesting and the more...
The first one is no different than Web 1.0 in the sense of somebody's server is now in Belgium instead of in
I agree
Des Moines,
with that.
Right?
So but I think notice we should go with the second one. The first can embrace some forms of communities that make their own rules. We all gather at en.wikipedia.org and we decide how it's going to work. And that's still a particular server in a particular place. It may be only distributed in the sense of how it chooses to govern itself, which may be kind of Web 2.0-y. But I think it's worth it to keep in mind, especially because you were saying there was the old Jack Goldsmith notion of states have guns and they can just come in and regulate, even if it's far away, they, you know, they have planes too. And then there's the, I won't call it old, the venerable David Johnson notion from the very beginning that said, what he perceives with this net is less a technological phenomenon for its own sake and more a social phenomenon that the technology can unleash, the opportunities for people to assemble themselves in communities of choice and set their own rules, first empowered to do so by being under the radar enough that no one outside of them bothers to regulate them, and then maybe to exploit, even in Web 1.0 thinking, the fact that they're far away or hard to identify or there are no global identifiers or something, that it's hard to enforce some rule against them.
So putting my professorial hat back on, let's go with version 2 rather than version 1 for the complexity factor.
Yeah, so going with version 2, what interests me these days is that a lot of the thinkers who recognize the power of the distributed in the social sense, facilitated by distributed technology, make little distinction between people coming together in a civic sense, the kind of sense that I think David often has in mind, and sort of even his idea with eBay, where eBay is disclaiming power it might otherwise have as a private company, trying to put it out into the users. And Facebook has, with very mincing steps, tried to do the same thing with Facebook governance. Versus the basic center of gravity of books like We Think by Charles Leadbeater and Here Comes Everybody by Clay Shirky and Wikinomics by Don Tapscott. All three of these books tend to lump together self-conscious civic movements online, trying to establish an identity and establish a governance structure for it, like Wikipedia, with other attempts to simply harness distributed people out there. So to me, when people talk about the magic of Mechanical Turk, that if you've got some problem that a computer can't solve, but that's way too boring for you to try to work on, if they won't do it for love, because it's not circling craters on Mars, maybe you can get them to do it for a tiny bit of money and just put it out to Mechanical Turk to do. And there's even some studies just starting to come out that say how many Turks are the right number to redundantly apply to the same problems so that you can adjust for bad ones. And that, to me, has a very different feel to it than a civic gathering. So that's something interesting to play with, to think about grouping distributed enterprises between the civic and the almost the opposite, the not-so-civic. I'm also interested in ways in which, just jumping back to internet architecture again for a moment, one of the lessons we thought we had learned from internet architecture and its success over very differently configured competitors was that having a very dumb network in the middle and smart endpoints was the way to go. That maximizes innovation, it maximizes certain kinds of freedom. But now that the endpoints that are smart are so smart that they are tuned into the network on their own accord all the time and reconfigurable from afar, often in a privileged way by the vendor of the actual object or platform, it totally upends, I think, a lot of the instincts that have otherwise been really salutary about the value of end-to-end as a metaphor. And when I look at the future of cloud computing, what I see is a functional equivalence between starting to keep all your data in Facebook, and their mincing steps at governance aside, they're just one phone call away from name your favorite state attorney general, from right. taking something down, from eliminating
or
an app.
Or Iran, for today's example.
Exactly.
Right?
That is functionally equivalent to the next generation of hardware platforms that we have that tune into the mothership, an iPhone to Apple, for privileged instructions on how they'll behave, a Kindle to Amazon. And that, to me, may betoken a technological reconfiguration as profound as the initial technological configuration that got people like David as excited as they were about the new social possibilities unleashed. I worry that I may be talking a little too theoretically. I'm happy to flesh it out with examples if people want.
Maybe you can
stop.
Help us ground it into a question that we can put to the group
yeah.
for the next 30 minutes or so, which is, now that you've had the benefit of this session, what is the hard question that this group of minds, of technologists and lawyers and others, should be asking and answering?
Well, saying this with all humility, not wanting to unduly attempt to set the agenda for this group, at least for myself, the things that most interest me are architectures we can build or adapt, little technological tweaks we can make as non-billion-dollar endowed technology firms, but we have some ability to write scripts and to, you know, actually shape the technological space. What are changes we can make there that can have a major impact, with our help again, on social configurations established around problems in the spirit of a .org? I mean, maybe there'd be cash flows too. I'm not sure what goes through the veins here, whether it's civic goodness or money. But when I look at how little MediaWiki, the software on which Wikipedia runs, has evolved over the years, it's a snail's pace how quickly that software changes. And yet, it's a handful of features there that make the idiosyncrasy of Wikipedia possible. The fact that you can dub someone, a handful of people, bureaucrats who in turn can dub some people administrators and have some extra privileges to change articles, or that it's easy to revert vandalism from one IP address down the line with just a few clicks. These kinds of very prosaic tools are what make its openness possible. And I can't imagine we have yet reached the grail of version 3.0, which for any product is two revisions in, so it's gotten good, but not so many in that it's decided that a paperclip is the right feature to include next. So that's kind of the... people remember the paperclip?
Yeah. I suspect so.
Those
were
good times.
Yeah.
Yeah, those were good times. It looks like you're writing a ransom note. Would you like help with that? That might include thinking through standards of a sort. And by that, I don't mean internet protocol standards, because that moves at a pace even slower than MediaWiki. but standards that can ride on top. So to think about Creative Commons as a movement that in a sense had an understanding of the cloud, because version one of Creative Commons was, we ought to set up a digital library of Alexandria. Anybody who creates work and wants to share it can give it to creativecommons.org, where it will be hosted and indexed, and anybody can get to it. And then, in part because of legal fears of secondary liability, should people submit stuff they don't have the rights to, it became a, oh, we're not going to host the stuff. We just want you to label it, and we'll give you the license with which to label it. And in turn, that license will have the machine-readable counterpart, and the library will just be the net, and the index will just be Google or any other search engine that indexes the digital tags along with anything else. And establishing those consistent tags has had a huge difference. And another example would be really simple syndication. Right? Talk about a couple young nerds, we know who they are, who sat down, came up with a standard for repackaging stuff that was already coming out online. Anybody could then write an RSS output or input, and with it, you have brought to life the vision of the cloud as a distributed network facilitated by the technology, and that's why you can't block Twitter very easily. Even though it's at twitter.com, you block twitter.com because of various syndication features baked into that. There are too many other ways in naturally rather than just as an emergency alternative. So I'd be trying to think about how to change those standards, how to accomplish the new things we think are important to do with standards or technologies like that.
Good. So David Johnson wants to reply, and then let's open it up. There's a lot on the table.
I want to put forward a possible line of attack. And I think the problems you've been thinking about come under the category of tyranny, defined as when one small group makes decisions without enough regard for the welfare of the people whose actions they're controlled. And you could say that the technology of surveillance that we talked about earlier this morning is another form of technological tyranny. I think the only plausible response is collective action. And we know that one thing that the current versions of the net don't do very well is to let us see ourselves acting in relationship to a group online. So my hypothesis would be if we could, and we know that even Creative Commons is essentially a solitary act and requires no continuous encounter with the group of people who share those values. So I think a move here that could be a first foundational move for cloud law is to make it easier for groups of people who would act if they knew they were acting together and could act more effectively if they were acting together to fight the unaccountable sysops of the world or to attach binding conditions on their distribution of their newly licensed material through Creative Commons in such a way that unaccountable power is constrained.
I'm not sure that feels to me like a line of attack. I don't find myself roused to disagree with you.
Oh, good.
I thought I was missing something.
Right.
We were hoping for an attack on Zichron.
Yeah, right.
We got that. We know you disagree.
But it also makes me think then, and this is a joint attack on tyranny together. It makes me think of Pledge Bank, a totally basic idea that you can understand in 10 seconds that a guy named Tom Steinberg can implement on a website, and who knows if that particular iteration of it will be the iteration that survives, but once that category has been created, you see a means of garnering people through a couple clicks for collective action of some kind, and away they go. Yeah.
Jim Moore.
What's interesting is to hear Jonathan come in very strongly at this point, but not having catched up to the very beginning. And what strikes me is that we have two kind of paradigms on the table. One just put on forcefully by Jonathan, but I think an opposing one, or a complementary one, put on the table earlier today. Most of the morning, for those who, the two of you who weren't here, was, from my view, about trusted third parties and the role of trusted third parties in playing a kind of a stewardship role for things that are very valuable and precious to the whole, and also very dangerous if they get into the wrong hands. But I think the assumption starting with Sandy's, you know, Sandy's thoughts about surveillance and what you do with sort of a world where it's not just websites people are creating, but people in their daily behaviors. I walk around this phone, it's creating a GPS trail of where I am, you know, day and night. And so Sandy's view is that and you showed very convincingly, but there's a lot of data out there already. There's more and more coming. I know some medical people who are doing stuff where you track footpads in a hospital. You see where everybody walks, and it's helpful to a lot of things. It's helpful epidemiologically to see how far people are walking. It's helpful to know where a doc is and all this kind of stuff. So who's going to take control of that? Who's going to hold that on behalf of us? First, physically. And then you can worry about the David Johnson, who's going to own it and who's going to control it. But it is a thing that will be probably held by a trusted third party. Versus, I think, the other conception. So that assumes that there are trusted third parties and can be trusted third parties.
Can you give an example of one that exists today?
In some sense, Google does.
A third party, trusted or not.
Any of the Facebook, any of the big cloud companies, Microsoft, that hold a lot of our information and our data are effectively trusted third parties. The Federal Reserve System is a trusted third party. We part of why we would laugh at that in a way is that we feel ambivalent about this trust. Okay? We'd like to trust them more, we think maybe we should trust them less.
But the Federal Reserve is a much better case than something. Google's got the free pass, but
Okay.
And the reason that the Federal Reserve is trusted is because you have private enterprise, a number of banks, plus the government, all watching what they're doing, and there is collective action through Congress about it.
Okay.
So that there's this sort of tension of all the interests to make sure that they don't screw up badly, although of course they may. So that was the notion.
But I want to bracket that because the notion there that government and business colludes to create trust, is really the opposite of the sort of other ideological frame, right? Because the other ideological frame, which I also find interesting, which is the government and business, and this is the Leslie Zittrain frame, I think, is that government and business inevitably will collude to do bad things. And so what you need in the web is widely distributed control that no collusive party can own. So what I find interesting is these two things are on the table. Okay, one model is kind of trusted third parties are necessary. The other one is, we've got to get an architecture that keeps us out of the hands of third parties. And then I think there's also a sort of an economic model to this, which is that there's this. This fiction that you can, the web is free, right? Well, it's not free, right? The web is free for certain uses for certain people at certain times, but the capital budget of Facebook this year is going to be in excess of $200 million, mainly for servers, okay, and power. I mean, it's actually real expensive to do cloud computing, not free, and it's also real sophisticated. It's not about scripting. So we have these two sides, right? We have the script world and distributed world, and then we have the, hey, it takes a whole lot of capital world, and it's about trusted third parties. And I think we have to reconcile the two. I think that our view going forward needs to be not one or the other, and that's really about all I've got to say.
So I understand. Well, we had a little side discussion here about this, and there are versions of distributed and centralized that are interesting. So for instance, you're going to have a centralized, trusted third party. And in the way I think about it, it's a sort of mutually assured destruction. That's why the government and industry give trust is because they're trying to blow each other up. But then, in fact, you may not actually trust either of them with actual original data. And you may hold that yourself, encrypted. And they never keep, for any long length of time, actual original data. So the data itself is distributed on things that each person personally owns, which is, of course, not quite as secure, but then it's a limited amount of data, too. And that the things that are held in common are abstractions of that only, which, of course, are a great deal of value. But it's hard to actually take those abstractions and turn them around for destructive purposes.
Cindy, is your view that we should go in one of these directions or another as an architectural matter? And maybe David or others comment on that?
I have a view of what we should do as an architectural matter, yes, and it's informed by having a lot of experience with this sort of data on people's bodies and so forth. Because, you know, years ago I had all my guys running around with computers on them and doing all sorts of weird stuff. But I can't claim it to be the only way to go or that I can prove that it's the right architecture. It's just that it seems to be, with lots of people thinking about it, an architecture that offers a few opportunities for complete meltdown. And it's not what I would call an elegant solution, and that everything is easy, but it seems to have the right checks and balances and the right difficulties in getting at the really sensitive data. That means that it's very unlikely that you do that except for very high net value individuals or something like that.
Kevin? A way to undo the genie coming out of the bottle, if it was even in a bottle. A lot of the cloud scale data is not in bottles. It's the result of, as Sandy says, of inferences from original sources. Right?
Which is to say, presume leakage and then deal with it from there?
Presume leakage. Prevent leakage, you know, there's a subroutine that says if you can contain it and prevent leakage, that's great. That's great for,
whatever.
You know, nuclear secrets, not even good for that, right? But for information about people and information that matters to people, we've got to step away from the container thing. What I think is interesting to come back to is what we've got on the floor, which is this question that maybe we've created finally an opportunity for really flexible jurisdiction, right? And what you call jurisdiction, but also kind of creative jurisdiction, forum shopping or whatever. There may be, you know, a zillion useful kinds of dispute resolvers and people who will hold you accountable. Beyond, I'm sort of suspicious of this term trusted third party because, first of all, trust sounds unitary, right? And I don't trust the Federal Reserve even with money, much less with, you know, knowledge about other things. And so there's not a unitary definition of trust. Maybe for setting interest rates, maybe they're trustworthy for that, right?
But could you trust this trusted third party in the sense that it's a digital corporation? You still couldn't draw that.
Because by definition, its incentives are different than the group of people it regulates. Unless it is a member of, or consists of that group of people it regulates.
That would be ideal.
Yeah. But once you elevate it to be the trusted third party for the planet, you know, 80% of the groups that are interested in being regulated, or maybe 99.9% of them, don't consist of every member on the planet. They're minorities of who have significant interests, right? And that's sort of the bug of, you know, sort of flat democracies, right?
Now you're going right at Johnson, though.
Anyway,
right?
so that's kind of the question is, can we be creative and also in a way that actually works?
Yeah.
Because as a pragmatic soul, you know, I know ultimately, you know, penalties are really important. And policing is really important, and you know, judgments that can be, you know, held are important if the data is important, right? So if somebody's gonna, you know, accuse me of committing, you know, sort of a civil offense or a tort or something against somebody else in one of these groups, it's completely pointless if that group has no enforcement mechanism, right? So it's not the, you know, we have to look at the structure of that entire system, not just hypothesize there's a group, but hypothesize the mechanism by which it works.
Extremely helpful. Oliver, I can tell you, I'd like to jump in, but I suspect Johnson wants to reply too.
I was going to take up some of what David actually did, which was to try and shift us back again to my question of in rather than of. I think we were straying back to of, which is not opposed to it. Because the cloud could evolve from the cloud and be something, you know, that's part of the task we can set it. But it also is exactly as you're saying, there are any number of things that people do day to day, which we're saying are going to migrate more and more into this kind of space. Facebook is replacing other forms of social interaction as the major organizing piece of how people figure out their social relationships. If that's the case, there will be legal questions that spin out of that, which are not just about the idiosyncrasies of the cloud, but are also about, you know, how people deal with each other. And I use that as only a single example. Is there that kind of structuring I'm talking about, that kind of legal law with a small L, something that we will build into the cloud? And if so, you know, under what jurisdiction? There's a whole set of questions about that, which is to me at least meets my interest because I'm that kind of lawyer rather than the law of the web, which is a different kind of lawyer.
I just pose a really simple thought experiment. You know, my kids do this weird thing, which is a socially supported thing in Facebook, which is to do homework with their friends on the web, right? You know, as opposed, or not on Facebook, rather, on Facebook rather than using email or other traditional things. And I don't even quite understand what doing homework on Facebook is, but it's clearly a collaborative process and so forth.
It likely involves chatting.
When they're
right?
caught cheating, which is one enforcement question, on Facebook, hey, how do they get caught cheating? What is cheating? What is relevant to just their little kid context? You know, that,
and
I don't know.
And what happens when teachers start to log on to Facebook and then log on there all their kids, you know, as the evening progresses and see what folks are up to?
I mean, there could be some other sort of choke points. So for instance, you could imagine having some sort of regulation that says you can't set up relationships that are symmetric. So if you get to look at me, I get to look at you. So that's an example where you haven't said what the architecture is, but what you have done is you've said there's certain sorts of relationships that have to obtain. Another one would be you can't collect, there's sort of a minimal amount of data that you can collect and retain ever. Right, so it's just not acceptable that we take the data and we just keep it, because you don't need that for almost anything. You might have to collect the data, get rid of it, keep a model. And you have to actually, to some enforcement body, show that you have the minimal representation of the data for your purposes, and that you don't have any more of it. So those sort of two things would drive architecture in a lot of ways. And it might drive it, I don't know how it would evolve. But it might be things that are enforceable and would be set in place by standards and APIs and things like that, and tradition. And they might end up having the effect of having some of these nice properties.
Just to build on that, we talked about this some last night about symmetric lack of privacy. I think this is a really important point, which I just want to emphasize. I think many of the things we fear with loss of privacy are actually things that happen when the loss of privacy is asymmetric. That is, if you know something about me, but I don't know anything about you, I do have things to worry about. But if the loss of privacy is symmetric, that is, if you know about me, but I know about you too, and in particular, if I know what you're doing with the data about me, many of the things we worry about go away. There's not nearly as much bad that can happen.
Yeah, the Burton Group actually did a really good paper, blog post on it in regards to relationships, and there's a whole part of relational symmetry which explains all this and the whole business model aspect, which is pretty awesome. So, I don't know, how do we have a way of, like, after this, sending information out to people, like different papers that we find and sharing?
Well, we have a wiki, we're putting stuff on the wiki, okay, and then we have, so, and so they're various folders, you can put the papers, and the number of papers are already there.
And if you wanted to hack MediaWiki and make it 3.0, you could do it from there too, right?
So the way I sort of understand it, the way I think about it, is there's three things. So sort of, there's the laws that have some principles and are considered to be somewhat immutable, or at least they don't change very frequently. They change in some duration that people consider. Say that it is this at some point in time, then on the cloud you have these sort of policy things, right, that may exist, that may be terms of use and those sorts of things. And then there's the actual behavior that kind of unfolds on the cloud through a collective. And they exist on the cloud to varying degrees. With Wikipedia, there's very few laws that kind of govern it. There's actually very few policies, but there is this kind of cultural behavior that sort of unfolded. And if one was to sort of change the proportions of those, said, well, I'm going to take the Wikipedia behavior now, turn it into a policy, it might actually change the nature of what Wikipedia is. And further, if I said, okay, I'm going to take the behavior, I'm actually going to make it laws, right, it may even further sort of change it dramatically from what, from how it's used and how it's perceived. But even further, if I was to say, well, I'm going to take the behaviors and I'm actually going to code it into the system so that the laws are not even necessary because the system doesn't even allow certain things to happen. So the behavior on the system is completely governed by the interface and it's encoded in the system. So therefore, you have no laws, you have no policy, you don't even worry about the behavior because there's certain things you just simply cannot do, and there's other things that you're sort of forced to do by the system because there's no other way. There aren't alternative ways of doing it. So that's when I started thinking about that. So this idea of the practice of law being on the cloud. So at what point do we get law being practiced on things like Wikipedia? And if that was to happen, and the practice of law was sort of encoded, what would that end up looking like? Would it just be lawyers by convention and agreement, or would they end up with other policies, or would lawyers have laws to govern how they create laws on the cloud?
It's interesting to me that we started earlier where David Johnson was talking about the Lessig 4 modes with a little variant, and Jonathan's always adding the herd into the Lessig 4 modes as a fifth. And you could take what you've just described and really put those in the 4 modes in their interplay terms. You've stacked them 1, 2, 3, but you know, the law and markets and social norms and the code are the things you were talking about. It's actually a very durable concept that we seem to be restacking in this new concept, but that it's actually still working as a, one of the design features here. Herbert, were you raising your hand a minute ago? No. Others?
Stabilizing my head.
Excellent. Multiple travels. Good to know. We're stable down here. The law may be evolutionary, but your brain is stable, right? Yeah. David Johnson, you have been invoked here many ways, implicitly and explicitly. Do you want to send me last word?
I think we're not paying enough attention to the need for diversity of rule sets here. When you suggest that maybe we should have a rule that we should only allow symmetric exchanges of information, I get chills down my spine about, maybe that's the right answer, and maybe people will all choose that, but unless we give them the choice and allow the choice to morph over time, we're not going to get the right answer. And because the net and the cloud are global, we're almost certain to have groups of people who have very different values. So the question, I think, the most fundamental question of cloud law is how do you allow diverse groups of people who have seriously different values to coexist? And that's essentially a meta-jurisdictional question that says, how bad does the outflow of harm have to be from a group before other groups that have whatever powers they have a right to take action against those other groups or ignore them, right to ignore them, and so forth. And I think once we solve that problem, we can be more comfortable that the system as a whole will evolve in response to what people actually want.
I think since we're at our time, I might just grab Jonathan's last comment and stick it on the end of David Johnson's last comment, which is, it seems like the best way to imagine a diversity of rule sets and systems is, in fact, to go build them, right? This is one of the things that this environment lets us do, is mess with it, test it, decide whether it was good, have it evolve, and I think that's the kind of genius that we could come up with in this group, is multiple experiments going, and then a stable way to analyze those and determine whether, in Burkert's terms, it's an evolution that we like or one that we want to roll back and try again. So thank you for this far-ranging conversation.
Oh.
I thought I was getting a last word.
You wanted a last word?
Well, I don't know. It sounds kind of anticlimactic, though.
Yeah.
I wanted to just thank everybody for not mentioning ICANN. It's like a snow day in school. Like, finally, we're free of the shackles of thinking that whatever we have to do, it has to do with ICANN. So.
Thank you for that.
Don't think of a penguin.
We tried. We had an agreement not to mention.
So the next section is to get to the